birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me, yeah. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. It's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel.
Good afternoon. You've got Living Writers on WCBN FM Ann Arbor. I'm T. Hetzel, and today I'm so happy to have Brittany Rogers here in the studio with me. Brittany, welcome to Living Writers.
Thank you for having
me. Welcome back to Living Writers. I mean, long time no see. It's been since December 2024.
But that's been a whole year already.
Oh my God. Hasn't it though? Hasn't it? Oh my gosh. Well, let's put a pin in that for a second. And can you, thanks for picking the songs for today's show. Can you talk a little bit about why this first song? And yeah.
Oh,
because it just seemed so. I almost thought maybe we should listen to the whole song.
Nina Simone is just one of my favorite artists, and this song is like such an affirmation for me, and just a reminder to like kind of reset and just focus. So it's one of my favorites to listen to if I'm like trying to usher myself into something.
Yeah. And it feels like the start. You have an Abad in here too, poem in your book, Good Dress, that's on the table with us out with Tin House.
Yes.
So maybe we'll even hear that one.
Maybe.
We'll see what you have in store for us today, Brittany Rogers. But yeah, it does feel like a year since so much has happened since we've seen each other. And in the world,
yes,
this country, and me, and how is life as well? Actually, you know what? Let me do the time honored tradition of your bio,
okay,
and then we'll go from there.
Okay,
because otherwise, I could see me just getting carried away and just chatting.
Whatnot. No worries.
So today, Brittany Rogers is here. The book on the table with us is her debut collection out with Tin House Press. Thanks a lot. Thanks to Becky and Isabel at Tin House for sending Brittany's book too. And shout out to you all out there in Portland. Thanks to Jason Voss for being here behind the glass to engineer today and for actually updating the Living Writers website. That's like a news blast. So
yes.
If you want to start digging into some archives, Jason is actually, he's figuring out ways to find years that we have to look for. But okay, now, Brittany Rogers, this is about you today. This is about you. And this is from your website. Usually I read the bio in the back of the book, but I wanted to read this one, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I don't mind.
Brittany Rogers is a poet, visual artist, essayist, high school teacher, and lifelong Detroiter. Audacity is the overarching concept that activates her creative process. As a Black queer femme, Brittany is fascinated by the boldness and risk-taking that daily survival necessitates. As such, her explorations of audacity often lead to an interrogation of the connections between the audacity of Black women and pleasure, longing, autonomy, the erotic, adornment, coming of age, and matrilineage. As a whole, Brittany's creative work pokes at the notions of respectability, ownership, beauty, and obligation, and is constantly looking to subvert the heteronormative and patriarchal expectations that are placed upon Black femmes. She has work published or forthcoming in Prairie Schooner, Apogee, Indiana Review, Four Way Review, Underbelly, Mississippi Review, The Metro Times, The Breakbeat Poets, Black Girl Magic, Obsidian, Literature and Arts in the African Diaspora, Lambda Literary, and Oprah Daily. She is editor-in-chief of Muzzle Magazine and co-host of Versus Podcasts with the Poetry Foundation. Her debut collection, Good Dress, is out with Tin House Press, as we were just talking about and celebrating. And what a wonderful book it is.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
And I love that on the cover it says a once in a generation debut.
That was from Angel's blurb. That was so Angel Nafis, which is so generous of her and so kind.
But it feels just right. I can see why it's on the front of the book.
I hope so. My fingers are crossed.
So let's talk about your history with writing poems, mm-hmm. and performing poems aloud. Mm-hmm. Was Little Brittany a poet that was writing? You were in the library, at least.
Yeah, I have
a sense of your young self,
yeah,
as a library user in Detroit public libraries, that yeah, there's a presence in good dress.
I was definitely a library user. I wouldn't say that like Little Brittany was a poet, but angsty teenage Brittany was definitely a poet.
That is a good time.
That's a way to name it. but I started writing loosely in high school. I joined in ninth grade. There was like a poetry club at my high school, and I joined that because I was interested. And then I ended up switching over to Inside Out Citywide Poets because one of my friends was a Citywide poet, Danielle White. And
can you say a little bit about Citywide Poets?
Absolutely. Citywide Poets is an after-school organization that's ran by Inside Out Literary Arts. And for me, it just has been so transformative. It was a great start to seeing myself as like a professional writer. They put a poet. So there's an in-school program and then there's the after-school program, which is what I was a part of. We would meet once a week. We would get like workshops from these professional writers. At the time, I was so spoiled and I had no idea. My first poetry teacher through Inside Out was Matthew Osman.
Oh, yeah. Matthew.
Erica Foreman was there teaching. Like, I was just Francine J. Harris. I was so spoiled and I had no idea.
Vivi Francis?
Vivi didn't work for Inside Out at the time, but Vivi was definitely adjacent to the program. So there were just like all of these amazing writers that I was surrounded by that were teaching us, and that was really at our necks, like making sure they're like, okay, this line break could be cleaner. How could you challenge yourself with this? How could you challenge yourself with that? And that was so formative for me. And it wasn't until I was like writing and beginning to publish that I was like, oh my God, I was writing poems with Matthew Osman and I wasn't even asking him important questions. I was writing dumb love poems. Oh my God.
And he loved it. And I'm sure they were also made stronger, yeah, like maybe broken open in some way. But sometimes you write through things,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, for sure. I'm a much stronger writer because of my start with Inside Out, for sure.
And it almost like having that sort of, and you said it was like weekly, Brittany, mm-hmm, that you have a whole language for even talking to other poets about their poems, right?
Yeah.
Which is a gift because not everyone... I don't know. It's sometimes hard to find a place into a poem, even if you know you love it or there's mm-hmm some connection to it or it troubles you or there's something that's happening in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's still like it's a practice to even have a way of feeling like you can talk about them or to
yeah
ask questions of them to possibly make them their fuller selves or whatever.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it gave me a language and Inside Out also gave me like a community of writers and just things that, again, in hindsight, I'm so lucky to have. And I was so spoiled and had no idea of how spoiled I was.
But you still have that community now.
Absolutely.
I mean, your acknowledgement section in itself are pages, Brittany. And those names are in there.
Yeah, they were at my wedding. My husband, we met through Inside Out. My best friend, Ajane, we met through Inside Out.
And your co-host on the podcast. Mm-hmm.
And my co-host on Versus. Yes, my one of our good poet friends called us a literary spousalship.
Oh.
And we were like, we're gonna hold on to that. That's real cute.
I'm writing that one down too.
That was real cute. But so, yeah, everybody who I'm like in really, really close proximity to, I've met in some way through Inside Out. So,
Yeah, and keep that community going. And to have been friends
for so long is really something special.
Because in a way, like having people that you trust to be early readers of your poems can make all the difference.
Absolutely. And these are people who have been reading my poems since Justin and Ajanae since like my early 20s. So for a very long time. So they know kind of like when I'm being lazy in a poem, when I'm like, okay, I've used this metaphor 50 times, they know and can call me on it immediately, whereas somebody else might not know that. Or they know when I'm like hiding in a poem. So it's just it's really helpful.
And it's not always easy to hear, but it can be useful after you've heard it.
Yeah.
I mean, in the moment, sometimes it's like, all right.
In these days, it's fine. Like when we first were editing each other's work, it would be like, oh my God. Or Justin. I think Justin is like the most concise of all of us as an editor. So he's very sparse with his language. It's either yes or no or cut or this.
Oh.
So in the beginning, I would be like, don't look at my poems because you don't know how to say nothing nice.
Yes, a little kindness to start. Right. Like, or
he's like, the niceness is implied. Like,
yeah, because I love this enough to want to engage with it with you, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes that's even like, that's teaching in a way too. And that's one of the other hats. Like, that's your day job.
Mm-hmm.
High school, 12th grade
12th graders.
Teacher.
Yes. AP Lit in ELA.
And so are you also like, well, with AP Lit, probably like shoehorning a bunch of like poems in there? Like, how are you getting some of this, like the sparks in there, which I'm sure you are?
I mean, yeah, with both classes, I'm pretty big on bringing in poems, but I also... I mean, it's too late now. I was going to say, don't tell my district, but it's whatever.
not listen for this moment. Yeah.
We have a curriculum, and I follow the themes of the curriculum. I do. And everything else I bring in.
Yeah.
So I just make sure that like thematically it's on point. And then I'm like, okay, well, what novel can I layer in? And what poems and what podcast episodes and what videos and like TED Talks, like what things can I layer in to tackle the themes that they want us to tackle
and make it so that the students have like on ramps into something too.
Exactly. And things that are like culturally relevant to them and things that they actually, you know, that hopefully they'll remember. And also because they're so close to college, there's like a rigor, I think, that sometimes surprises people if they haven't necessarily had it, especially in literature.
Oh.
And so I'm all about like, no, we're reading Toni Morrison. They're like, beloved, what is that?
They are so lucky.
But
that's
I'm
like
coaching
the best...
them through, you know, yes. what I mean? Through reading it so that when they go to college, it's not their first time being exposed to that type of literature.
And beloved, and to have like a community to read a book with, that book has the stories within it, of course, the language, the lovely phrasing.
Yeah.
Like I would just write phrases and put them up around like my temp job cubicle.
Yeah.
You know,
it's a genius.
Yes. Right. Yeah. But I can see like your phrasing and love of language throughout Good Dress. Would you read a poem before? That would be just so we can. Yeah. Hear your voice, because I know folks got to hear back in December, Detroit Pastoral.
I'm actually going to read a poem about me and my cousin, because she's on my heart today. I come from like a really strong matriarchy. They're everything to me. And this poem is called Pauling Blood. Pauling is our maiden name. Pauling Blood. Whenever my aunt recounts the tale, she says she should have known. Muttering about pawling blood, our hard heads, soft behinds. She told me and my cousin to stop running in and out, wasting her good air. When we grabbed the skates, she forbade us from putting them on until we made it off the front porch. Of course, we said okay, new to play obedient, hide behind the tiny lie. Of course, we galloped down the inside stairwell, the leather itching a hole in the center of our hands, so greedy we were to slide them on. We know this part of the tale by heart. The skates were on our feet before the screen door slammed behind us. I remember creeping down first, slow as an old watch, holding my breath as my cousin inched toward the sidewalk. So you see, I was watching when her right leg flew from beneath her on the third step. We both knew her arm was broken before her elbow split clean as wishbone, before my aunt heard her scream.
Thanks.
Oh, you're welcome.
I'm thinking of her now, too. I loved that poem.
Oh, thank
it's so,
you.
It's so vivid. And with the skates.
It's so very typical of us. we were a hard-headed bunch, I must say.
Well, that's probably part of like what makes the matriarchy strong,
yeah,
and necessary.
Absolutely. I think that the woman in my family really modeled for me that I could do literally whatever it is that I want to do. And they also taught me to be a big girl enough to accept the consequences of whatever I wanted to do, but always made it clear that whatever I wanted to do was mine to do. And I really, that formed so much of my foundation that I think it gave me like just a really unshakable confidence that I'm really grateful for, that I'm really, really grateful for.
And they're throughout your mom, your grandmother, your great grandmother and great grandfather even are throughout Good Dress, but you're especially your grandmother.
Yeah, that's my heart. I'm a granny's girl.
Is that the dedication at the start of the book?
Yeah, it is.
That's for Gloria Jean Young.
Yeah.
My whole heart. Let's take a short break. Today on Living Writers, Brittany Rogers is here. The book on her table, her poems, her book of poems, Good Dress. I'm T. Hetzel. We'll be back. Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, I'm so glad you did, because Brittany Rogers is here today in the studio. Her book, Good Dress, out with Tin House Press. We've got Jason behind the glass today. And Brittany, was there a reason for this song? I know I was kind of chatting to you off air there, so I'm not sure you got a chance to really.
I'm a sucker for a ballad. That's really the moral of the story, is that I love a good love song. My students are always like cracking up at me because I will listen to the slowest, saddest song. And they'll be like, are you okay? And I'm like, I'm having a great day. What do you mean?
Are you playing it in the classroom too? So they're like, okay.
I'm like, I'm having a ball. You're not having a ball with this? And they're like, ma'am, no, I'm sad now.
I'm like kind of crying exactly. Slightly. Yeah.
They're like, I'm heartbroken. I'm like, I'm not heartbroken. I'm in a great mood. I don't know, something about the clarity of like the lyrics and the clarity of the vocals. I think you have to have a really strong voice. And sometimes a really unique voice. Like my favorite voices are not always like the strongest and vice versa. But I think that there just has to be like a clarity of vocals there if you want to do ballads. And that's why I like them.
And then it's like you're feeling the person that's mm-hmm. there, right?
Yeah.
Is that like even those, the edges or the like, parts of them, like where it that doesn't have to be perfect, mm-hmm. but it has to be something where you're
it has to be something that's like unique to them. Like I love Rihanna's voice, even though it's not like a classic, you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's not like a classically traditional voice, but like I love her voice.
And when you're with your with connecting it back with your poems, mm-hmm. and because on your I love your website, on it there's like one of the things ways you can engage and interact is like you can see performances that mm-hmm. you've done.
Yeah.
What is, because in that you use your voice in a different way, mm-hmm. and yourself then how maybe I've seen you like interact with good dress, mm-hmm. for example.
For sure.
What can you talk a little bit about that? Like what it's like, and I don't know, the place of it in your creative process and your life as a poet?
For sure. I came up in slam. So that's something that's, I spent a long time slamming. And I think slam taught me so much. I think there's something about performance that really makes you want to feel a poem in your body. There's something that takes it away from being like more clinical or maybe like strictly academic and makes it personal. Makes
like
it,
those line breaks you were talking about. Like,
yeah.
Well, they're important,
mm-hmm.
but they work in a different way.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Where you have to pause a line is very different in performance than where you have to pause it on the page. On the page, I feel like you really have to like build a double meaning in where it might be more easily apparent in like a performance. It's really then on like your tone. Like I think that there are just ways that with performance you can make things clearer to your audience. Whereas like I think when you're on the page you have to trust them to kind of just know that they're gonna get it.
Because you're really guiding when you're like at least getting a sense to see these videos.
Yeah. With performance, you definitely get to like, you know, your tone rises or falls. And then the audience knows like, oh, we're upset or oh, we feel this way. And I think that that's really cool.
And you're hearing from them, too. At least it felt like the audience were responding in the moment
lines
and parts. and that's part of slam, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. That audience participation. Slam is very communal, and I think that that is something that I love about it. It's very some of my favorite authors today are people who I slammed with, people who beat me in slams, people, you know what I mean, who you might have run around, I might have won around, but people who I admire deeply. Like there are regional slams. There used to be a regional slam called Rust Belt. And I remember my first time, like, watching Danae Smith and Sam Sachs and Franny Choi. Watching them all slam was just like, oh, my God, they're so great. Human Yin. They're so, like, brilliant. And they're bringing so much to performance. Like, there are people who I'm like, okay, I want to learn from you. I think that that's really, really, really cool. So to see everybody's, like, trajectory. You know, through slam, out of slam, but also still very much carrying that element of what it means to have a poem live in your body. I think it's been really, really cool.
Do you have poems like that in Good Dress?
I don't think I have any poems that are even long enough to slam. With slam, you have to.
Right.
Slam poems are usually like, they have to be shorter than 3 minutes, but they're usually somewhere toggling right around there. Like you're timing yourself and there's somebody in the back on your team who's like counting you down. Like, okay, you got like 5 seconds left. So you're trying to like cut it so that you don't get a time penalty.
Thank you. Cause I mean, I feel like this is a crash course. Like I've been to slam, but I feel like I've never participated or performed in it,
mm-hmm.
and so I'm not sure that I ever really knew the intricacies of that and how it's It's a different, it's an art. It mm-hmm. doesn't make poetry a sport,
mm-hmm.
but it's making it definitely alive in a different way that's maybe kind of paying tribute or not giving a nod to more the performance beginnings of poetry.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it's also competitive.
Yeah,
so you have to be
it.
In like your A game. You have to have your stuff together. And it just challenges you to do better. And it challenges you in real time. Like, I remember when me and Ajane were prepping to go to grad school and we were talking to a poet, William Evans, who we also met through SLAM. And he attended the school that we were both like thinking about applying to, which we eventually went to and like got our MFA, got our MFAs from. But we were talking about it and he was like, yeah, workshop is nothing compared to SLAM. Like, as slammers, you'll do great in workshop, because some people get really intimidated by the idea that other people are like going to look at their poems and give them feedback and edit. But when you're slamming, you're literally getting feedback on the spot. So if your poem does not land, you know right that second that your poem does not land.
Yeah.
If a judge does not like your poem, they have no problem being like three and you're like, oh.
And that is that like out of 10?
Yes, it's out of 10.
Okay.
So a three is definitely a bad score.
Yeah.
Or a three is a score you don't want to get. I'll put it like that. So you got just like that live constant feedback. And it was really clear immediately, like whether you had your audience or whether they were like drifting. And then that kind of helped you edit. Like, so I would know, okay, this particular thing isn't working, or this isn't clear enough, or this isn't pulling the emotion that I wanted to pull, because you can see it literally in the audience. So
when you're like working on your poems, like are some of these poems, are these from the time in grad school too?
Yes, yeah, some of them are from the time in grad school.
How long have you been working on Good Dress, Brittany? What would you, yeah.
So it's interesting because Good Dress had a couple of iterations. So I think almost all of the poems in Good Dress were written during grad school. I started writing this collection in like 2016, and in 2017 it was still a chapbook, and it was at that point pretty much entirely about motherhood and family. And then I went to VONA, which is a writer retreat for people of color, and I workshopped with Willie Perdomo, who's brilliant, and we talked a lot about just like ways to expand it. And I realized, I'm like, oh, I do have more to say. Like, okay, this is a full collection, cool. But at the time I thought it was still about motherhood, and I felt very obligated for it to be about motherhood. I think I was
why do you think
I don't know. I think maybe because that's what I started out writing about.
It felt like maybe that was the project idea initially.
Yeah,
that was the wellspring. Or
yes, and I think, I don't know, I think that there's just a way in which I felt indebted to that experience and really wanted to explore that experience. And then by the time like 2019, 2020 came, I was like, okay, great, I'm ready to submit it to different places. So I still thought that that was the book, but I was also very weary of it. Like, I was like, oh my God, I'm so tired of these poems. They need like some help. They need another set of eyes, but I don't know what. So I started sending it off kind of just to get it like out of my face.
Go now, go.
Yes, like let's unhand me. And then somewhere in that process, maybe by like my second semester of grad school, end of my first semester, beginning of my second semester, I was talking to a mentor, Philip B. Williams, who really just kind of asked some very important questions to help me see that I'm like, I'm really not interested in these poems anymore. I really don't feel connected to them the way that I did. I'm not excited about them. And then it was like, okay, well, then what am I excited about? And at that point, I think the last maybe four or five poems that had been written for the book, those were the things that I was like, oh, I love these poems. And they were about migration. They were about, I didn't know it at the time, but I was beginning to think about audacity as like an umbrella for things. And then I scrapped the rest of the poems. So I left only what I was excited by and scrapped everything else. And
that's a brave thing to do, isn't it?
Yeah, not it. When I reflect on it, yeah. Yeah, but I think I'm a person who's always felt like once I know something, then I have to address it. So I don't do well with like knowing that something needs to change and not changing it, or
for me, knowing pretty much immediately equals action. So once Philip kind of brought that to my attention, he kind of was like, you could all write this book right now. And I was like, that is a big thing to say.
That is. I mean, it's actually like a big compliment, even though it would feel like maybe, again, a hard thing maybe to hear in the moment where you think,
yeah,
well, these are, this is what I've worked on for so long.
Yeah, and you've that was hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but then, you know, that you have like the poet that you are has a different work to do in that time, mm-hmm. to make that group of poems, that vision.
Yeah. It just was like, because I think what I was explaining to Philip was that I'm like, okay, I know that each of these poems needs edits. I just don't know what, and I don't know where to start. Yeah. And his thing was kind of like, well, why would you reverse engineer each poem when you could just write new poems? Yeah. And I was like, actually, that's fair.
So how many did you, like, how many can you roughly remember, Brittany? How many you ended up? Because there's a core, because there's strong motherhood in here.
Mm-hmm. None of the original poems made it. None of them. None of them.
So maybe that's why it's also, because it's not like, it's also very, it's not typical for motherhood poems too, is what I would say. Like, let me just qualify that. Like, what do you mean by that to you? That's what the listener is saying. What are you talking about? But one was like, I feel like it's the one you might have written for Ajahnay. Is it one where you make a call from the hospital?
Yeah.
At the 3 a.m. poem, yeah. Or so? Is that one?
That's one. Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. You're like, yep. I was planning to
read that one. That's why it's so cute. I was planning to read that one.
Do you mind reading it?
Sure. I got you. Because we were talking about Ajahnay earlier, and I was like, oh, I could read this. Okay. I'm just finding the page.
I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll be right back. And then you know, everyone, you're going to get a poem right away. We won't talk much, I promise. Brittany Rogers is here in the studio. Her book, Good Dress. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Never been a morning kind of person per se, but it's never hard to open my eyes to you every day. You've never been a night owl who likes staying up late, but baby, you are. And baby, you do, 'cause you meet me halfway. This ain't my first rodeo, I've been down this road before. Nobody loves me like you. You're my future, past, present tense. I go to hell and back again if that's what you want me to do. Nobody but you.
Welcome back. If you're just tuning in, you're just in time. Brittany Rogers is here on Living Writers, her book, Good Dress. Brittany, thanks for picking the songs for today's show.
Thank you. I was over here jamming. I love Brittany Spencer.
It's so hard. Yeah, it's hard to fade out. You don't want to fade anyone out. Anyway, but let's actually pull the focus up back on you, Brittany, and your book of poems, Good Dress, and the poem that you've got.
This poem is from my best friend Ajahnay, and it's called The Year They Left Everyone to Die. Fact, I feared I would not live through that last labor. Fact, sometimes, more than half the days, no, nearly every day,
Anxiety licks my face with its wild, irrational thirst, and I feel its damp threat for hours. My therapist gave me a worksheet to track my catastrophic thinking, but I am valid this time, contracting, watching my blood pressure leap. You FaceTime from Ohio to monitor how they place the IV, the epidural, the flat hospital pillow behind my humid back. Fact, you are the first call I make after, at 3 a.m., over the sound of newborn lungs learning themselves. I promise, I did not make you drive the 3 hours back home to tend to my dry nipples, my everything bleeding, my hair unbound, sparking at the roots. Some things take hours to dig through. What has a lover seen that you have not? Can I tell them you set me down and parted and greased and twisted, that for a week all I ate was made by your hands?
Thank you. Thanks,
Thank
Brittany.
You.
And that's for Ajahnay.
Yeah. She's probably not listening, but
we'll
the love
her
of my life, I'm gonna send it to her.
Yes, we'll send her the link on the website. So, thanks for reading that one. Those final lines, especially. I mean, you have to build everything in there mm-hmm. for those to like be mm-hmm. for the reader when you get to that moment. Mm-hmm. But I just thought, wow, it just felt like there was such strength there and love too, where you say everything that I've like you've made
mm-hmm.
like sustenance, everything.
I think a lot about the intimacy that exists outside of outside of traditional romantic partnership, because I don't want to say our friendship isn't romantic. It's very romantic.
Yeah, there's a meet cute.
We do, yes.
Like how you met. That's a story. That's like, yeah.
Yeah, and we do all the, I can't, there are very few things that I could do with my partner that I wouldn't do with Ajahnay. So I think that that's just as important for me to write about and talk about as it is like that, you know, traditional romantic form of love and intimacy. And even thinking back on that time, the year that I was referencing was 2020, although at this point, every year is 2020. I saw a tweet that said that 2025 is just 2020 hiding like in the trench coat, like the stacked little people.
Totally, the stacked little people in the trench coat. We see you.
Right, you're not fooling us. Yes. But that was a terrifying year for a lot of reasons. And it was especially terrifying for me because I was pregnant and my pregnancy was high risk. So we had like this pandemic that we didn't know what to do with, and we didn't have we still, quite frankly, don't have a solution for it, but we certainly didn't have anything then. So I'm like going to the doctor 2 or 3 times a week because the pregnancy is high risk. But I'm like, okay, I can't shake anyone's hand and I can't take anyone in here with me. And my family was like very, very, very sequestered. And it was just like a very lonely and very scary time. And I think that the survival of that time was really made possible by like the sustaining of friendship. And even like after we had the baby, like Ajahnay literally, she quarantined for 3 weeks so that she can come up and see me. And that was like one of the most romantic things that anyone's ever done for me. You know what I mean? So then it's extra absurd to think about how friendship gets left out of like talks of intimacy or talks of romance.
I just don't believe you can leave it out.
I don't either.
Yeah. So thanks for choosing that poem to read today.
Oh, no problem.
It was just right.
Oh.
Just right. In the poem, you also mention the therapist giving you a worksheet.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's kind of interesting because it's a thread into other poems in Good Dress, where you have a series of non-traditional forms, mm-hmm. like poetic forms, I mean, mm-hmm. very traditional forms, like you might find, like to fill out in different offices. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because you include some worksheets from the therapist yeah. in here.
Yeah, because I was thinking a lot about the absurdities of some of our like systems and industries.
Yes.
And as a neurodivergent person in a completely neurodivergent household, everyone in my house has, you know, a brain that's doing a little extra, shall we say. And so, you know, their treatment plans and medications and all of those things. And I'm always struck by how hard navigating those systems are. And I'm the person in my house who does like the navigation of those systems. So there have definitely been times where I want to like really fuss at doctors because I'm like, that's such a silly question. What do you mean? Do I ever feel anxious? Of course I feel anxious. I feel anxious every day. Have you seen my chart? Have you? Do you see the world? Like I want to just gesture at everything. Look at all of this. And you're like, you know, or the things I think that interact in weird ways with like with race or with gender. So things like one of the recurring questions is something like, you know, have you felt so tired that you had to take off work? And I'm like, see, now we're talking about class because I don't ever get to take off work. I can't afford to take off work. So you're asking me the wrong question. The question is not, have I been so tired that I could take off work? The question is, do I have the ability to do so? And the answer is no. Right. So this is a silly question. You know yes. what I mean? This is a yeah. silly question.
Yes.
Not to get too personal, but when my grandmother passed, I had a really, really hard time. And my psychiatrist was suggesting that I do like a inpatient stay. And I was like, well, I can't because I have to work. He was like, you can't just take off. And I was like, I would lose my job. Like, y'all live in a different land than we live in. So it was really, really hard even to get treatment then because the only treatment was, you know, you have to come in and be hospitalized. And I'm like, okay, I hear you. And that sounds delightful. And that's probably really necessary. And also, the tangible necessity is that I have to feed my kids.
And then so. It feels worse to then yeah. be like, well, there it is.
Exactly.
But not for you.
Exactly. Because he's like, well, that's the only alternative that I can give you.
That's not enough. That's not the full answer. It can't be.
Exactly.
Like, do your job.
Exactly. So I think that's where those poems started, was just thinking about the absurdities that we have to encounter yes. with institutions and how they then roll into the rest of my life, right? How it's all one big tangled thing together. Like it's something that I can't really separate.
And so with using, cause you use other forms, you use like mm-hmm. the abad, like mm-hmm. we said, like the morning poem or song. And there's a villanelle in there, a villanelle, right? I think with repetitive lines that
are there's a pantoum.
Back. Oh, it's a pantoum.
I'm not a villanelle girl, but it's a pantoum.
That's right. Okay, I'm not.
I was pondering. I was like, no, that's great.
The forms. Yeah, it was. But yeah, but so the pantoum. That's better. Let me write that down. Okay, so we get that right.
No, I was gonna say I suck at villanelles. I'm so bad at them.
Well, apparently I do too, because I was convinced that was like as soon as no, I saw those similar. Lines coming back.
They're similar.
Yeah. But then you also have these other more literal forms mm-hmm. that how did you decide to structure Good Dress? Because it's not all like those are together. Mm-hmm. They're sort of it's woven like you've got the book sectioned, but they're throughout. Except the maybe order? In Good Ground. Yeah.
Yeah, the order was the hardest thing for me, actually. Good Ground is a sonic crown. And I knew that I wanted it to go in the middle. Like, I knew that immediately. And then I ended up making the decision to space it out. So it's not, like, immediately apparent as a sonic crown. But it's, like, a crown of seven sonnets. But then the other poems, I think I just... I think they actually mimic the way that my brain works, which is that it's very cyclical. And so I looked first at like, okay, if the person reading this only reads like the first 5 or 10 poems, what do I need them to know? And then I ordered it that way. And then I just kind of like let it cycle back around until it kind of evolved and told like a full narrative.
I love that. That's so cool to hear as an approach to a structural experience, right? Like
yeah.
To order it for the experience for the reader in that way.
Thank you. It felt so hard because I was like trying to make my brain legible to people. And sometimes like the easier way to do it is like thematically or chronologically. But I was like, that just isn't, none of that felt like the right fit. So.
Oh, I'm so glad you did what was hard.
Oh, thank you.
What are you working on now with the poems?
So right now I'm working on a project that is like visual art. That's it's a lot of poems. It's thinking a lot about beauty and adornment and grief and longing and desire. It's thinking about the desires of Black femmes and how they get addressed or don't get addressed in domestic spaces. It's thinking about the ways that we use like beautification as like ritual, as safety, as security, as a form of honoring. All of those things are kind of folded in.
That's going to be wonderful.
Oh, thank you. I hope so.
Have you been working on this for a while, Brittany? Because it feels like a lot of like what, like the energy on the website, for example, is also this. Like it's even though it's there now also to put forth good dress, definitely. But it feels to me like that energy is already there in the site. And also definitely parts the good dress. It's not coming out. It's not like, oh, an about face.
Yeah, I think that that some of these are things I've just always been fascinated by. And I don't think I realized that I was really asking myself some questions until maybe 2022-ish. And that's when I was like, oh, I'm working on a project. How funny.
Yeah.
But I noticed like all of my collages had that theme. And then my poems that I was starting to write had that theme, even with me writing through a lot of grief. Beauty was still something that was like really present. So
as like a presence or as something that is helps you survive the grief or as something in and of itself, beauty?
I think both. I think as a form of honoring grief, I think beauty is used a lot. Even I think if you're thinking about like funerals and services, the ways that people dress up for funerals, the ways that we dress the body, the ways that we care about the fact that the body has to be dressed a very specific way. I'm really into Aretha Franklin, and I was reading an article from her, like, longtime beautician. He had been a beautician for 35 years, and he did her hair for the service, and he said that he just kept hearing her voice in his ear, and that's how he knew how to style it exactly, because he could, like, hear her being like, no, curl this way, or curl this that way. And he was like, it was the honor of a lifetime, you know, just to dress her and make sure that she looked like herself, right? And I think about how much, just about how important of a ritual that is. And it's something that is not important to the person who's transitioned, right? It's important to us. So kind of unpacking why and things like that, like all of that's in there.
And Brittany, you mentioned working in visual art, and then you said collage. So is that like a regular part of your making practice then, or is this new? Maybe working with
it's newer probably since 2022, when my grandmother first got sick. I became one of her caretakers, and we didn't know how sick she was at first. And I couldn't write anymore. So I turned to collage because it was really the only thing that I could do. And it was the only way I could articulate myself. And the first series was just different pictures of her. And all the pictures I had of her currently were her in the hospital. So I would remake us into like different places. So we would be in the tropics. We would be, you know, at the mall. We would just be anywhere but there.
And would she see these too, Brittany?
You don't know. I don't think I ever showed her any. It kind of was just, I don't think I did a lot of talking during that season either, because it wasn't much to say other than I'm very sad and this sucks, you know? Yes. And caretaking is really difficult. And so I would just go home and make things. And I don't think I showed any of them to anybody for a really long time. It was just kind of the only way that I could translate like what I was feeling into something, you know, something outside of my body.
That makes sense. Hey, before, I know we're going to be running out of time here soon. Could we hear some of your new poems that you might want to share?
Absolutely, you can. I'm actually going to read this one. I'm going to pivot because I plan to read something different, but I'm going to read about my granny since we've been mentioning her.
Oh, thank you.
No problem. So, funny story, just to lead in so that I'm not like in tears.
I pretty much almost am, everybody.
The night before my granny's service, the night before my granny service, I had like a braid appointment. So I had taken my hair down. I blow dried it. Super poofy. It's unreasonable. It's unreasonable hair. And out of nowhere, we get this wild storm. It snowed. They called it like thunder snow or something. Like, it was ridiculous. And so it wasn't even that we had snow that was so deep. It was that it was like slushy and just unmanageable. And a lot of power lines went out. All those things. I don't know if you remember that big storm.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
The person who was supposed to braid my hair, it knocked her power out, but only her power the entire shop. And she couldn't travel to me because the weather was so bad. And then she got to her house, her wires were down, like everything was just really, really chaotic. And all I could think about was like, okay, I can't go see my granny like this tomorrow with my hair like this. It was such a stressful thought. And that's part of what like made me think about the writing of some of the nuances of beauty and how they intersect with grief, because it's, you know, she could see me now, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
She sees that my hair isn't done. She's seen me with my hair undone plenty of times, but to send her home, I don't want to send her home like that. So I wrote a poem about that experience, and it's called Before the Service. Before the service, that night, the city closed its blinds and left us to fend for ourselves against the harsh snow, the thunder applauding the sky. I imagined my grandmother watching from across that thin veil, fit for a bride, that she's the reason the storm didn't swipe my car off the road on the way to the emergency braid appointment, after the first braider lost power in her booth. I had to beg for this slot. Same day, late evening, snow flooding the street. On a different night, I might have tried to tame my own roots, but how could I chance a failed twist out, a poofed out press and curl, my granny girl watching from the altar as I walked into her funeral unkempt? I couldn't bear to fail her in that way, looking unloved, messing up her good name. I know my granny loved me down, would have bent that roaring sky and came back home to me, if only. And then I'm going to read this other short one because I think it's a companion piece to the first one. It's called After the Service. Again, her body pulled clean of breath, resting in the polished casket I promised not to climb in. I'll start over. We dressed her in a white nurse's uniform, a shiny coat of clear gloss. If she were really here, we would have giggled behind our hands, pressed to our face like church fans. What is the stuff you got on my lips? She might have asked. Skirt and lip gloss aside, she looked just like herself, unadorned and still the prettiest jewel in the sanctuary. I can only stand to look at her face for so long. I was supposed to be writing about beauty.
Thank you, Brittany.
Oh, thank you.
And I love how that last line where you say, I was supposed to be writing about beauty, but you are.
Yeah.
Like, no.
Thank you.
Well, these are new poems. These are new poems for the next. So, okay, everyone, you can read all the poems we talked about earlier in good dress. So we do have 10 houses probably out there. Yeah. Like Becky and Isabel are like, another word.
They're a great press.
They are.
Yeah,
right?
I have
they
to read their like they're, great they're, press. Top 10.
They,
wow.
They are. They're, and they're lucky to have you. And,
aww, that's so sweet.
And I can't wait to talk again with you, Brittany. And thank you for these beautiful poems
today
from good dress and these new ones, sharing them with us today. Let's talk again.
Absolutely. I would love that.
Come back at new time. today on Living Writers, Brittany Rogers, her book, Good Dress. Thanks to Jason for engineering. Thanks again to Becky and Isabel at Tin House for sending the book. Oh, and shout out and thanks to Nandy Comer for connecting Brittany
yes.
and us. I definitely wanted to get that in. And folks, you know, check out the website because Jason is making us proud again. it's getting updated, folks. So thanks for listening today. And hi, Mom. Until next time.
That's so cute. That's how
I want a Sunday kind of love, a love to last past Saturday night, and I'd like to know it's more than love at first sight. On a Sunday kind of love. Oh yeah, yeah. I want a love that's on the square. Can't seem to find somebody, someone to care. And I'm on a lonely road that leads to nowhere. I need a Sunday kind of love. I do my Sunday dreaming, oh yeah, and all my Sunday scheming, every minute, every hour, every day. A certain kind of lover who will show me the way, and my arms need someone to enfold, to keep me warm when Mondays and Tuesdays grow cold.
Wrap your troubles and dreams. Take four.
Castles tumble, that's fate after all. Life's really funny that way. Sang the wrong melody, we'll play it back. See what it sounds like, hey, hey. They cut out 8 bars, the dirty bastard. And I didn't know which 8 bars he was gonna cut. Why don't somebody tell me these things around here? Holy Christ, I'm going off my nut.
The last bastion of freeform, WCBN FM, Ann Arbor. Sounds like a bunch of left-wing hippies to me.
Oh, jeez, that mic is on.
The mic's on. Oh, my God. Turn off the microphone.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to another episode of WCBN FM Radio, FM Ann Arbor. Today, I'm going to be your host, Henry Wong, joined by Vihan Iswar. And how are you doing today, Vihan?
I'm in a good mood. You know, weather's a lot nicer than it's been in the past few weeks. Had a very light day class-wise, got to wake up at 10, so that was nice. I'm excited. I'm ready to talk some sports.
Yeah, so why don't we get into it then? Let's start with the Chiefs. You know, Chiefs moving on to another Super Bowl with a possibility for a three-peat here. I'm going to face the Eagles next Sunday. How do you feel about that?
I have no interest in watching that matchup. I mean, obviously I'm a Giants fan who does not enjoy the Eagles, specifically a particular running back, succeed. And I think, like most of us, I think we're all a little frustrated with seeing the Chiefs just rattle off these three straight Super Bowl appearances, gone for a three-peat. Obviously, you have to give them their flowers. They've been very, very good. One of the best teams in NFL history. But it's A, repetitive, and B, they haven't been particularly fun to watch. And then that's factoring in a lot of the controversies that people perceive this team to be associated with.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I think you kind of touched on a little bit there. There's kind of two sides of the fence here. People, obviously, on, you know, the historical side, where this is, you know, the first time